Well, thank you for that introduction. Thank you for coming here. I do want to mention God's superintending of all that occurs, including our lives. I appreciate the introduction. Sometimes I get congratulations on having been married for 33 years now, and I hope many more to come. And it's actually my wife who deserves congratulations, not me. I mean, she's the one who's had the hard task, and it's been easy for me. But even with the ease of being married to Susan, I am thankful to God for what He's given me and also what He did not give me. At times, I have written articles about baseball, interviewed a lot of baseball players, and some married, some not married. But the temptations they face are just absolutely enormous when they're on the road, and it takes a great degree of faith and perseverance not to fall prey to those temptations. And since I was cut from my baseball team when I was in the sixth grade, and realized at that point that I probably did not have a major league future, I was freed of that thing, which could certainly affect marriages. And then I have, as you can see, what is known as a radio face, and thus free of that pressure of in a sense, if women had thrown themselves at me, I don't know if the marriage would have survived, if I would have had the faith and integrity to say no at times. So I'm very grateful to God for what I don't have, as well as for what God has given me. And let me just mention one other thing as far as the way God works. Since you mentioned the situation with the so-called Republican Revolution of 1994, which did not last as a revolution very long. And here's one of the reasons it didn't. In 1995, as you heard, Newt commanded all the members of the Republicans in Congress, or at least the incoming members, to read the book I had written called The Tragedy of American Compassion. And actually, a lot of them did so. In 1995, I was asked to speak to many of them, and they assembled, and I did, and explained essentially what the book was about for those who didn't actually want to plow through it. And at the end, I said, if you really want to understand this, here's what I suggest that you do. That either in your district, when you go home there on the weekend, or in Washington during the week, without the cameras rolling, without any attention, go and volunteer for an hour a week, tutoring a child or doing something else that would actually put you in direct contact with the poor and folks who are in need. And just do that consistently. Now, if you're wondering what political benefit will come from this, you know, eventually some reporters will find out you're doing this and they'll ask about it, and you'll probably get some favorable publicity out of it. But that's not the reason to do it. The reason to do it is to, for those of you who are Christians, to glorify God, for everyone to educate yourself so you have some personal experience, some epinosis and not just gnosis, some personal knowledge rather than just abstract understanding. And at that point, it was interesting. Most of them were with me this way, and I felt a communication, but at that point, it all broke down. And just about all of them were saying, well, we don't have time for this, we can't do it, we have this, we have this, we have these other priorities. And that, I think, in some ways, early on, showed a problem with the new Republican majority in Congress. There were a lot of people who talked a good game. There were a lot of people who had desire to do things, but they didn't really want to be personally committed in that way. And the Republican change in Congress did some good, but pretty quickly they started doing the same things the Democrats were doing, of lots of pork barrel stuff and so forth. So I'm just thinking about these things because if we're going to understand prodigal occurrences, and in fact these things I've been talking about yesterday as well, to move from being prodigal sons, whether as younger brothers or older brothers, to a biblical understanding of things, that requires a level of personal commitment that we need to pray that God will give us. Prodigal doctrines, it is very easy, as I was saying yesterday afternoon, to talk about social justice, but social justice can very often become social injustice if, in fact, the things that are done in an attempt to promote social justice, lead people away from God, push people away from God, then biblically you are promoting injustice, not justice. And prodigal occurrences, my subject for this morning, moving from medieval understandings to Reformation. I'll give you an example of the types of individual thought that's required to do this. And this past weekend, I was at a conference put on by, I suppose, my favorite Reformed Baptist, John Piper, was speaking about, this was a conference dedicated to, or in honor of John Calvin's 500th birthday, which has been celebrated this year. And I was speaking about the way that Calvin brought about a revolution in thinking, moving from medieval understandings towards a Christian enlightenment. That's still very much with us, still very controversial here in Baptist circles as elsewhere, the role of John Calvin. But it affects, not just in the abstract, it affects the way we should think even about news events. And so here's one of the ways that John Piper, thinking in his Reformed way, in terms of emphasizing the sovereignty of God, raised some eyebrows last month with the kind of news analysis that was common in the 17th and 18th century. The Piper Conference at which I was speaking was held in the Convention Center in Minneapolis, and last month the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America had its big conference there with pastors and members from all over the country, from that denomination, meeting there. And while they were meeting there and making some news by voting to be willing to ordain gay pastors who were not abstaining from homosexuality but actively involved in it, while they were voting to do that and discussing it, a tornado touched down in Minneapolis. And it's very rare at this time of year, and particularly in those weather conditions, that there be a tornado. And this tornado was a very strange tornado, strange not only in coming in this month, it's not the tornado season, but also touched down in one area of South Minneapolis, I believe, and then jumped up and did very, very, very minor damage there, and then came and blew away the tents that were surrounding the convention center as hospitality booths for the convention, and knocked off the cross on top of a big Lutheran church just across the street, which was the church providing hospitality for this convention. And John Piper thought about this and wrote about this, and he noted that the Minneapolis temperature was only 68 degrees, no severe weather predicted or expected, and then the tornado damaged the roof of the convention center and knocked off the cross from the steeple of Central Lutheran Church across the street. Now, what do you make of this? Is this a completely chance occurrence? Quite possibly. But Piper logically laid out why he did not consider the tornado and its path to be an accidental occurrence of volatile atoms. And he wrote, I'll just summarize quickly what he wrote. He said the unrepentant practice of homosexual behavior, like other sins, not singling out homosexuality as the worst or greatest of sins, but like other sins, that will exclude a person from the kingdom of God if this is continued unrepentant behavior. And the church certainly embraces those who forsake sexual sin and turn to Christ in faith while still struggling with homosexual desires. I mean, all of us struggle with sin of various kinds, yet God forgives those who, through his kind providence, turn to Christ in faith. Piper noted that that quote, official church pronouncements condoning the very sins that keep people out of the kingdom of God are evil. They dishonor God, contradict scripture, and implicitly promote damnation where salvation is freely offered, end quote. So this is serious business. Sometimes people, whether it's fighting poverty or looking at the problems of homosexuality, will say we must be compassionate to those who are poor, in need, or immersed in sexual sin, whether homosexuality or heterosexual adultery. Piper says, well, that's not compassion. And I think he's accurate in that. It's not compassion to promote damnation where salvation is freely offered. It may make people feel warm and cozy, but it's not compassion. And then third, Piper observed that Jesus controls the wind, including all tornadoes, and that there is precedent for seeing seemingly random calamities as God sent. And you know from the Bible that Jesus referred to a fatal tower collapse as a warning that displayed God's command to repent, because none of us will otherwise escape God's judgment. Now, Piper wrote this, and he concluded that, quote, the tornado in Minneapolis was a gentle but firm warning to the ELCA and to all of us. Turn from the approval of sin. Rejoice in the pardon of the cross of Christ and its power to transform left and right wing sinners, end quote. So here's my question. Is it over the top to say that God may have sent that tornado to warn the conventioning Lutherans and all of us? And I'd have to say no, it's not over the top if we have a full-orbed sense of God's providence. How can we prove that God used it that way? We can't, and after all, Episcopalians, let's say, have also been approving this particular kind of sin, and their conclaves did not cave in. These are mysteries. God, under Satan's prodding, collapsed a house and all of Job's children. Why doesn't he, in the middle of the night, collapse the buildings where abortionists by day carry on their murderous work? So these are good questions. In other words, the question for me is not whether God can form and direct a tornado. Obviously he can, but why he doesn't do it more often. If the absence of a tornado doesn't prove God's approval of an event or organization, so the presence of one does not necessarily show God's disdain of it. And the Bible shows God's opposition to abortion or unrepentant homosexual behavior, so we don't need a tornado to tell us that, although it does serve as an effective reminder. And so I probably would have put Piper's reaction in the form of a question rather than a statement. In fact, in writing in World, I did just that, saying, you know, this actually is a very thorough, logical, rational, biblical way of looking at it. We don't know for sure that that's what happened. So we should perhaps ask the question. There's a Lutheran professor named Jerry McDermott who emailed around a photo of the shattered steeple with the cross knocked off and asked the question, was this God's command? Here is a picture of what happened to the top of Central Lutheran Church at about this time yesterday that the ELCA approved a social statement which implicitly rejected Orthodox understandings of sex and marriage, end quote. So I think that's probably the way I do it. Was this God's command? And that's an important question to raise about any occurrence, whatever, that happens. It's an important question for journalists to raise. And let me just note that American journalism began with people raising that question. In 1681, there was a general meeting of Massachusetts ministers that urged careful coverage of illustrious providences, including divine judgments, tempests, floods, earthquakes, thunders as are unusual, or whatever else happens that is prodigious, including remarkable judgments upon noted sinners. So this is the beginning of American journalism in 1681, and John Piper is very much operating in that tradition. And World itself is also, although again, we did phrase it as a question to which Piper's answer made sense, but we couldn't definitely say this is what it was, because journalists basically are supposed to report what is true and accurate and provable, in the sense that that classically, if a journalist is standing in front of a house that's painted white and is asked what color is that house, the journalist should respond, the front of the house is white, unless he has already seen the sides and the back. He should not go further than the facts allow. So this is one journalistic way of looking at prodigal providences. Here's what happens, realizing God is in charge, realizing God can do this, and he often has done this. We may not know in this specific instance, but it does serve, as Piper says, as a general reminder of our sin, and also a reminder of God's mercy, in that God could have had that tornado slamming into the convention center of the church and people could have been killed in the process. No one was killed, no one was injured. It was a very gentle, merciful reminder to us. Now, one of my problems with a lot of contemporary secular journalism is that reporters don't seriously report the possibility that a particular problem has a spiritual cause. The New York Times had two rather long articles about the ELCA convention, and particularly the victory for the pro-homosexuality forces within the Evangelical Lutheran Church. And in those two long stories, the tornado, the knocking off the cross, and so forth, was not even mentioned. Because, of course, to New York Times reporters, coming from a secular proposition, that thought is absurd. So why waste precious space even mentioning it? There were some other publications, including Associated Press reports, that did mention it, sometimes noting that several of the delegates had referred to it as here may be a sign of God's thinking on this, but sometimes just in a jocular way. I mean, that some of them absurdly reported that this may have been coming from God. But at least it was reported. But the New York Times and many other newspapers didn't even report that, because, again, why waste precious space on something that is absurd? Journalists in America these days regularly spike the spiritual. Spiking is an expression in journalism from the old days when people would put in stories and when the editor had finished with them, sent a revised copy or something, he would take the old thing and just put it out. He had a big spike on his desk, and it put the papers in there to hold them. So spiking the spiritual has been a common practice in American journalism. And when journalists pontificate about the root causes, to use that expression, the root causes of poverty, or the root causes of the Israeli-Arab conflict, they regularly spike the spiritual. Some of this old-time journalism or new-time in John Piper's usage would be very useful to get people thinking, to serve as gentle reminders that God is, in fact, in charge of the universe. But in a way, we're at the extreme opposite of where we were in medieval times. And this, I think, is the way we don't, that at least in the New York Times and other publications, we don't even consider, the reporters don't even consider the possibility that this may be part of what God is doing, in fact, that this is the world is a stage for the drama that God is unfolding, and that all of us are broken sinners, ruined sinners on a ruined stage. You go back to medieval times, pre-Reformation, many Christians understood what was taught by the Roman Catholic Church, that work in a church or life in a monastery was the best way to follow God's will. So the theater of God was not the whole world, but only the parts of it, where priests removed themselves from the world. And now the New York Times tells us essentially that there is no theater of God, that the material world is all that there is, and that the possibility that a tornado could be God-sent is beneath contempt. It's not even worth mentioning. I am very impressed by Reformed Baptists like John Piper and like your president, Dr. Moeller. And as I mentioned yesterday, when I became a Christian, at age 26 in 1976, I started reading John Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion. And they had a big effect on me, in part because of their very logical theology, but in part also because the activity of God that they described explained well my own experience. I knew I had not been a searcher. I was a runner, running from God, not wanting to bow down before him. But the hound of heaven kept running me down. So my sense is, from my own experience, from the study of the books I've written about journalism, and then my experience with world particular, a Calvinistic understanding, a Reformed understanding, is very important to Christian journalists. And the lack of that hurts a lot of Christian journalists and hurts all of us, as we think about prodigal occurrences and God's role in them, possibly. The events of the day are truly important only in what they tell us about the nature of God and the nature of the world that he created. Calvin wrote that, quote, if God does nothing random, there must always be something to learn. If God does nothing random, there must always be something to learn. And this is a crucial understanding that impelled the growth of the original, the first colleges in America, like Harvard and Yale, both set up within this Reformed understanding originally. A 19th century minister said he opens up the newspaper to find out what God had done the day before. I like that. Of course, I also like in the 21st century here, Cal Thomas, he has a line that, as he put it, he, uh, he reads the Bible each morning, and then he turns to the New York Times to get the other side. That's not bad. But the importance of believing that what happens in the world has significance. I think of that journalistically, but I think this is important to all of you. It goes far beyond just questions of journalism. It affects the way we think about all kinds of endeavors. Reformation leaders told their followers that they were all key actors in the theater of God. And so they emphasized paying attention to the events around them. And this is such a striking change. I mean, here's one of the things the Reformation did. And you can see this even by going to an art museum. Artists patronized by the medieval Catholic Church deliberately did not pay attention to what was going on around them. Jesus told his disciples, look at the birds of the air, but artists either did not look or they didn't help others to look. And the reason for not looking is that realism, reporting in a sense what was going on either in journalistically or by realistic paintings, that was virtually a heresy. They knew, the medieval artists, they knew how to use perspective in drawing. It wasn't that hard to figure out, but they didn't use it. They had generic figures floating off the earth in medieval artwork. And why? Because the overall goal was to separate from this world. And so artists depicted separated saints. The Reformation emphasis on providence indicated that daily events gave us some knowledge of God's mind at work and play. So reformational mindfulness, pay attention. Pay attention to the news events around you. Pay attention to what might seem to be chance occurrences. Pay attention to surrounding languages. Christian intellectuals had heard for centuries that they should write in Latin. But Luther wrote in German. Calvin wrote in French. Both preached in a way to be accessible to the broad public, not just scholars. Their sentences were short and clear. This was a change from lugubrious prose so remarkable that historians of language see Luther and Calvin as instrumental in creating modern sentence structure in German and French. So as pastors, I mean, and a number of you will be pastors, it seems to me it's very important to try to impress upon your congregation the way that these occurrences that we may think of as chance occurrences are not. These areas that we may think of as secular are not secular. There's really no divide between the holy and the secular in that way, that what goes on outside of church is just as important as what goes on inside of church. That if you hear this expression, full-time Christian service, I think you should say, well, no. All life lived to God is full-time Christian service. It was medieval thinking that said there's full-time Christian service in the monastery or as a priest, and everyone else is leading a lesser life. This was not Reformation thinking at all. And insofar as we fall into it, sometimes we're falling back into medieval patterns of thinking. And what I hear from back in 95 when I was talking to lots of congressmen, and they were all churchgoers of various sorts. I mean, some genuinely, some for political reasons. But when we talked about a Christian understanding of politics or a Christian understanding of economics, they normally said, you know, I don't hear anything about this in church. In church, I hear about lots of things, but not about the things, in fact, that impact me most in what I have to do in making decisions about legislation and so forth. So I want to talk a little bit specifically about these two fields that are often ignored by clergymen, government and economics. And again, a lot of this comes out of the thinking of John Calvin. This is his 500th anniversary. I don't know if any of you have had birthday cakes here for him, but we owe a lot to his thinking, to the thinking of Martin Luther, and then later on to the thinking of those who followed in their footsteps, and the thinking of people like Al Mohler and John Piper today. But I want to mention, in celebration of the Reformed famous 5 points, I'll offer quickly five conceptual innovations regarding government and five conceptual innovations regarding economics that were brought about by reformational thinking, and particularly in many ways through the leadership of John Calvin. Starting one, what's important to do with your life if God's given you certain talents? I mean, should you go into the church? I mean, should you be in government? Here's what Calvin wrote in his Institutes, right near the end of them, book 4, chapter 20. quote, "No one ought to doubt that civil authority is a calling not only holy and lawful before God, but also the most sacred and by far the most honorable of all callings in the whole life of mortal men," end quote. I mean, this was revolutionary talk. I mean, here was life outside the church, here was life in civil authority, and Calvin was actually saying, this is the most sacred, the most honorable. So he was taking the secular and saying it's sacred. This was huge. Second, many Christians through medieval times had heard they should not go to court. And of course, we know it's wise to avoid courts when possible. We're instructed that in the Bible. But if you say never, then the weak have little redress against the powerful. Calvin wrote, quote, "As for those who strictly condemn all legal contentions, let them realize that they therewith repudiate God's holy ordinance and one of the class of gifts that can be clean to the clean. The Christian endures insults, but with amity and equity defends the public interest. They will not seek an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but they will use the help of the magistrate in preserving their own possessions," end quote. And it was thinking that like that that led Americans to push for a government of laws, not men. This was huge. Third, many Christians through medieval times had heard that rulers and magistrates could do virtually whatever they wanted. The powerful were bound only by their own power. Their edicts were not to be challenged by Scripture. But here's what Calvin wrote, quote, "Kings should not multiply horses for themselves, nor set their mind upon avarice. Princes should remember that their revenues are not so much their private chests as the treasuries of the entire people, which cannot be squandered or despoiled without manifest injustice. If, and note the if here, if kings want to be considered legitimate and as servants of God, they need to show that they are real fathers to their nations." And it was thinking like that that led Americans in the 1760s and the 1770s to argue that taxation without representation was tyranny, because they had a right to decide how their taxes should be levied and spent. Fourth, Christians through medieval times had rarely had the opportunity to vote for leaders. Calvin, in exegeting chapter 1 of Deuteronomy, stated that, quote, "Those who were to preside in judgment were not appointed only by the will of Moses, but elected by the votes of the people. This is the most desirable kind of liberty, that we should not be compelled to obey every person who may be tyrannically put over our heads, but which allows of election, so that no one should rule except he be approved by us," end quote. So that, of course, led to our system of electing leaders, that understanding, as opposed to being stuck with kings. It also, in many ways, led into reformational polity in Baptist churches and congregational churches, where churches elect their own leaders rather than have them thrust on them by Roman Catholic or Anglican leadership coming from the top down. Leaders came from the bottom up in this reformational understanding that John Calvin pushed forward. Fifth and final point on government. Many Christians through medieval times had heard that it would be unbiblical to rebel against those said to rule by divine right. But Calvin wrote against private individuals taking the law into their own hands, but he also wrote about the magistrates of the people appointed to restrain the willfulness of kings. He wrote that such magistrates must not, quote, wink at kings who violently fall upon and assault the lowly common folk. And he wrote that a refusal to oppose monarchs in such situations is, quote, nefarious perfidy, because they dishonestly betray the freedom of the people, of which they know they have been appointed protectors by God's ordinance, end quote. And Calvin developed this thinking, and then others among his disciples and their followers pushed this along. The infamous St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, the French government killed, well, maybe up as many as 60,000 Huguenots, French Protestants. That led more thinking about the right to revolution in certain circumstances. One Calvin disciple in 1579 wrote vindicia contra tyrannos, vindication against tyrants, which contended that even military revolt might be necessary to defend God's law, to defend God's law against kings who gave orders contrary to it. And as generations of Calvinists read Vindicia or other works that emphasize the limitations of power, the idea that government is almost like God, you can't rebel against it, disappeared. And you can trace through the influence over a couple of centuries coming up to the American Revolution. There's a book that just came out by Pastor David Hall called Calvin and the Public Square that does a good job of tracing this influence. I can trace it very clearly. I've written about Samuel Adams. In 1743, he defended his Harvard thesis that resistance to the supreme magistrate was lawful if the Commonwealth cannot otherwise be preserved. And John Adams and many others wrote out the doctrines that originated with Calvin and the Reformation greatly influenced Americans in the 1760s and the 1770s. So this stuff may seem, well, we all know it these days, but this was extremely radical in the 16th century. To sum it up, sin is always with us, but work in politics and law can at times glorify God. Monarchies can and probably will be ungodly. Republics are better since both rulers and ruled are sinners. Limited government is the best help to both. And when leaders try to be dictators, lesser magistrates, when a tipping point arises, can be righteously rebellious. So this changed the Christian understanding of government and politics. A second area, again, which isn't preached about very much these days, but is crucial and was crucial in reformational development, the whole idea of Christians as entrepreneurs, Christians working in economics. Christians previously had heard in many ways that work was only something that you had to do. By the sweat of our brow, we earn our bread, we are obliged to do it, and that's it. Work is a misery that has to be endured. Calvin had a different take on this, and the Reformation people had different takes on this. Calvin envisioned God as, quote, beckoning with his finger and saying to each and every individual, I want you to live this way or that, I want you to work this way or that. So each and every person, not just priests, has a God-given vocation that is, quote, good and profitable for the common good, end quote. So work itself is not a curse. Thorns and thistles, the things that make work very frustrating, are curses, but work itself is not a curse, and no work done to God is secular. Broke down the secular-sacred divide so that people outside the churches and monasteries were no longer thought to be leading a second-class existence. This was an enormous change, and a change that gave dignity to every person, not just the people, again, who were in churches or monasteries or nunneries. Second, Christians throughout medieval times had heard that the way to get closer to God was through some added-on discipline, such as penance or fasting or some form of self-flagellation. Calvin wrote that God did not require such celebrations of discipline, especially when it took productive discipline for Christians to earn their daily bread and to help others. Calvin knew that requiring what could be called hard practice could lead to harmful pride and a wasting of talents. Let me mention something about hard practice. It's an expression that's used more in Buddhism in some ways. I spent some time a few years back with some Japanese Buddhists who immersed themselves in freezing mountain streams on top of Mount Koyasan, or they sat for hours in the lotus position until their legs cramped up and they could hardly walk. I remember one woman in her early 40s, she had had a very hard life. She had been abandoned by her parents and then abandoned by her husband. She had one child, and when he was a toddler, she began coming to a Shingon Buddhist temple on Mount Koyasan and engaging in hard practice. I mean, she immersed herself in this freezing mountain stream. But it struck me that taking care of a small child is hard practice in itself. My wife and I have had four children, and especially for her, it was hard practice in many ways. And why substitute unproductive and unnecessary hard practice for productive hard practice? Yet this is something that Christians in medieval times, and even Christians today, are sometimes told to do. Fulfilling the functions that God has given us as parents, as employees, as employers in some situations, as workers or managers, this is hard enough. As teachers, as scholars, this is hard enough without trying to add on some other things. And let me just mention that today, you know, people who retire while still in good health find out that to quote what Calvin said, a removal of work, quote, would throw human life into ruin, end quote. You know, Calvin's commentary in Genesis 2, he wrote that, quote, men were created to employ themselves in some work and not to lie down in inactivity and idleness. Because after all, pre-fall, Adam was working as a gardener, as a namer of the animals, which required a lot of careful observation. And so the idea that that work is something that's just miserable is something that Calvin tried to fight against. And again, people in good health and retirement, they leave their work and their life is thrown into ruin very often. And Calvin, with many kinds of health problems, wrote and preached until he died. So here's the discipline of work as a calling and the discipline of service, particularly to the poor, but to others. Calvin got up early, he worked through the day. He had an absolutely an astounding output of writing in those days when the cutting edge of word processing was a quill pen. Just amazing. But this was the sense of that work is a very positive thing. It's hard practice in which God wants us to be engaged. And in fact, let me just mention one other thing. Calvin's stress on the importance of work led eventually to a different understanding of business. People have written about the Protestant ethic or the Calvinistic ethic in emphasizing work and diligence and so forth. But I think it even goes beyond that work was something significant. And in many ways, we fall short of that today. Let me just mention, I can bring up about five different levels of thinking about work and business creation. Level one is what some Christians in medieval times and today and at other times grudgingly accept. Work gets us our daily bread, but it has little value beyond that. Level two, grudgingly supports work because it supports a family. And then the money earned is also important because maybe it'll go to support missions and minister and missionaries. So level two is, yeah, work is drudgery. Grudgingly we do it, but it can have some useful focus if we tithe and perhaps we go beyond that and we support churches and ministries and so forth. Level three support, semi-grudging. Okay, you work at a job because it supports your family, and then you can give money to support church efforts and missions and so forth. But you can also witness to your coworkers, and so you have an opportunity in the workplace to spread the gospel. And that's a step up. Level four, and Calvin wrote about these things. Level four, being a steward, and at the same time creating multi-general wealth. Calvin, in discussing Genesis, advised his readers, quote, let him who possesses a field so partake of its yearly fruits that he may not suffer the ground to be injured by his negligence, but let him endeavor to hand it down to posterity as he received it, or even better cultivated. So stewardship, improvement. This goes with natural resources, it goes with products, it goes with all sorts of things. So there's another part of work. But I'd suggest even a fifth level. And I wouldn't be surprised if Calvin wrote about this. I just haven't seen it. But the fifth level is really work as a stage, another one of God's stages. Again, we are ruined actors on a ruined stage, but another one of God's stages in which you can do important things. If you're a boss, you can try to structure work so that your employees can exercise creativity, you know, work. The workplace is where we spend most of our waking, or more of our waking hours than anywhere else. And if you can do that in a way that allows for creativity, ingenuity to really bring out in a clear way God's image in all of us, then you're doing something very powerful, very important. When you don't do that, you have problems. And I'll give you an example of where non-Christian thinking left us. You look at the problems of the automobile industry. there was a bargain made in the 20th century. People, workers on the assembly line, would engage in robotic practice. They would be bored stiff for 8 hours a day, but they would earn some pretty good money, and then they could go to happy hour, or they could go to weekends that are made for Michelob, or in some other ways they could have real life, enjoyable life, creative life, outside. They had to do their 40 hours or 35 hours on the assembly line in drudgery. That led to that led to lots of sad lives and also lots of pretty bad cars at times. The Japanese actually tried to do something different. This was implemented in some factories where workers would not be in the same spot all through the day, robotically putting on a bolt or something like that. Instead, you'd have a team of workers that would actually be making a car. So they would do various tasks. And they could have the enjoyment of putting together a car the way that builders can have the enjoyment of putting together houses. You actually see the whole product developing. It's far different than being on an assembly line. But you had a system where, thinking unchristianly, workers made money, the companies made money, cars were produced, but these were not very happy lives very often in many ways, or at least not creative lives, fulfilled lives in the workplace. A bad bargain. Seems to me a bad bargain to give up 40 hours of your week just in drudgery and slavery. And this is where I think level 5 thinking, you think as an employer, how can I structure things to constantly leave our workers challenged and growing? I mean, I think of this as a provost. How do I do things so that professors are not just engaged in drudgery, teaching the same thing over and over again, but they're always having new challenges? And sometimes they may have become used to it, and they may prefer doing the same old, and just bring out old notes. But it's not good for them. It's not good for students. So you always, as a manager, want to, or if you're a pastor and you're in a large church and you have people working for you, you don't want to overwhelm them, but you want to whelm them, basically. You always want to leave your employees whelmed, but not overwhelmed. Anyway, let me get back to these points here and stop musing about this. Fourth, because I'll move along here. Another important thing. Christians throughout medieval times heard that they should not make loans. If you made a loan, you were engaged in the kingdom of usury. Calvin and then other reformers argued, and I think correctly reading the text, that biblical opposition to usury was not opposition to all interest-bearing loans, but to those that took advantage of the poor. A loan to grow a business is a lot different than a loan to a starving man. Charging interest in the former was legitimate. And in fact, if you ban interest in regular economic activity, you are reducing opportunities to promote business expansion and human flourishing. You're reducing opportunities to really try to sanctify the workplace. And Calvin's defense of interest was very important in his day. It led to an economic revolution. It led to the fact that that we here are well-nourished and have houses, have roofs over our head and so forth. Not the natural condition of mankind, which is poverty. But the affluence that developed is in many ways owed to business practices that were fueled by the ability to make loans. And it was important then, but it's not just historical. Muslim emphasis on Sharia law that purportedly bans interest makes these arguments very topical once again. Now, Muslim banks have a lot of ways to get around this, and they offer, in essence, the same thing as interest, but it's very convoluted. And so this is a relevant argument here once today. And then fifth, many people through medieval times had heard that the best way to help the poor was to give them something, give them spare food, give them clothes, give them coins. Calvin and others changed this. They taught and showed the best way to tackle poverty was not to distribute alms, but to open a business and to employ those who would otherwise beg. And the reason it's simple, everyone's created in God's image, is worthy of respect, is capable of contributing. Calvin wrote, quote, "We cannot but behold our own face, as it were a glass, that is a mirror, in the person that is poor and despised. Though he were the furthest stranger in the world, let a Moor or a barbarian come among us. And yet, inasmuch as he is a man, he brings with him a looking glass wherein we may see that he is our brother and neighbor." So this was a basic formula. God creates, man respects. This was very different from the thinking in medieval times. In fact, shortly before Calvin's birth, a French bishop invited beggars from all over Europe to come to his city of Lyon, France, so church members could more readily win salvation by contribution. You made a contribution to the poor and you knocked off your days in purgatory. So poor people from all over Europe came to Lyon, and soon the local resources were overtaxed, people were dying in the street, and church leaders had to call the whole thing off. So this was the idea of helping the poor. You want to give them stuff. Well, Calvin did not favor compassion of that sort. There really wasn't compassion. Compassion of that sort is the way that when I was in Texas, I had two dogs, and I would get up in the morning, put some food and water in their bowls, scratch them on the stomach, and they weren't working dogs. They would just lie around all day and offer me amusement, and that was their task. Well, that's often the way we treat poor people these days and homeless people. We put some food in their bowls. We enable them to lie around all day, and then we can feel very good that we have put food in their bowls. The Catholic Church in medieval times romanticized poverty, and the same condescending error occurs today. But here's what Calvin wrote. This is his commentary in Amos. He noted that poverty does not make people godly. It may even make them more susceptible to Satan's snares. Quote, when people are pressed by famine, they would sooner sell their lives 100 times that they may save themselves from hunger, no matter what the price, end quote. So instead of just emphasizing the transfer of resources, Calvin encouraged new businesses. And he taught that all vocations, except those forbidden by God, are good. I think he may have specifically said that assassin for hire is not a good occupation. But he redlined some like that, but all these occupations, all vocations are good. And Calvin, actually, I won't go into all this right now, but he took some very practical steps. He wanted real needs to be met. So Geneva at that point, a small city by today's standards of 12,000 people, big by standards in the 16th century, had 28 districts, each with a population of about 425. There was a district supervisor who screened all requests for help, presented to the deacons those that he thought deserved approval, and deacons visited homes to verify needs. And about 5% of Geneva's population received financial help, and almost always it was short-term. The deacons were trained to think entrepreneurially. Instead of just giving money, they would use church funds to pay for tools and raw materials and the initial rent on a shop so that refugees could get to work. So this, again, was very important. It underlies what became a very effective form of poverty fighting in America. Social Calvinism was the means by which generations of Americans moved from poverty to affluence. And then starting in the late 19th century, it was attacked by, on the one hand, by social Darwinism, in a sense social Darwinism on the right, saying we're better off if these poor people just die off. And then social universalism on the left, that everyone should just receive a transfer of funds, no questions asked. And social Calvinism was largely abandoned, and we've had a lot of problems since then, developing since then. But let me just sum up the economic thinking that I hope some of you as pastors could convey to your churches, because it's sadly not all that common these days. All honest labor is good, not just church work, and it's not second class. Self-flagellation is bad. We don't have to make life harder than it is. Again, if fasting helps you to think, to concentrate more on God, that's good. The other hand, with lots of people, it doesn't. It leads people to concentrate on their stomachs and their hunger. So that's not helpful in that way. Depends. You know, what works to bring people closer to God is good. What works to separate people from God is bad. Hard work is good in many cases. Interest-bearing loans that help businesses to expand and provide more work, those are good. The poor should work rather than beg if they are able-bodied and able-minded, capable of doing things. And even some who aren't fully able-bodied and fully able-minded, what can they do? No help should be given to the able but lazy. This was Calvin's model. This was social Calvinism. Now, Let me just mention one other thing here, because again, some of you who are Reformed Baptist, this may be useful to your understanding. You know, I started my first lecture yesterday with Joni Mitchell's "Both Sides Now." I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's clouds illusions. I recall I really don't know clouds at all. You know, a lot of people look at Calvin, and because of certain biases, he's not that popular in colleges and universities today. People think, well, maybe he only appreciated cold logic, not warm aesthetics. But there's a book that came out earlier this year called "John Calvin: A Pilgrim's Life" by a scholar Herman Selderhuis, Selderhuis. And I recommend that because you get a sense of Calvin. I think that is still important for us today, and for us as pastors to have today. For you as pastors, I would be an incompetent pastor as a purportedly ruling elder, but barely able to rule myself. Calvin says that God, quote, meant not only to provide for necessity, but also for delight and good cheer. Has the Lord clothed the flowers with the great beauty that greets our eyes, the sweetness of smell that is wafted upon our nostrils, and yet will it be unlawful for our eyes to be affected by that beauty or our sense of smell by the sweetness of that odor, end quote? So Calvin opposed any doctrine that deprives us of the lawful fruit of God's beneficence. And essentially, as opposed to the to the strained and cold sense that sometimes is given concerning this Reformed understanding, the idea is that God is very benevolent. God's very merciful. Even when in some of his remarkable providences, he sent that tornado, perhaps as a warning, but no one was killed in the process. We are to work hard, but we are to enjoy our work, and we are to enjoy the flowers and everything else that God provides for us. I could go on about, and I've gone on elsewhere and written elsewhere about some of the errors that Calvin and Calvinists made, and let me just mention one in particular. There was sometimes an attempt, and this was common in the 16th century. There was sometimes an attempt to use state power to force biblical ways of living. And this was a mistake. It hurt in the 16th century. It hurt in the 17th century when Calvinists took command in England under Oliver Cromwell and then sometimes tried to institute certain laws and restrictions and try to force government, have government trying to force people to live better lives. It doesn't work. It's the change of hearts that's important, and that's why when you come right down to it, it's pastors who are absolutely critical in this whole effort. Calvin understood, and I think we should understand as pastors or as elders, that this is the theater of God. There are a variety of dramas that God stages and we are involved in. There are many are tragedies. There's a lot of diversity, happily, providentially, in the world that God has made. And as Calvin wrote, quote, "How malicious and hateful toward public welfare would a man be who is offended by such diversity," end quote. So the job of the government for Calvin was not to violate, quote, "that conscience which God has engraved upon the minds of men." This is a rather limited function. It's an important function, and I think it's important for pastors to teach people, not to get political in the sense of endorsing a candidate or a particular piece of legislation, but to help people think biblically about the role of Christians on the stage, including the stage of economics, the stage of government, all the stages in which God has placed us. And particularly, I would hope that pastors would admonish our political and economic and cultural leaders that all of them, to quote Calvin one final time, all of them, quote, "are ordained protectors and vindicators of public innocence. Their sole endeavor should be to provide for the common safety and peace of all." Thank you for listening.